Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight.
Welcome to a very special edition of the Supertone Show.
Led Zeppelin, Black Dog, live in 1972 from the triple album How the West Was Won. And that was released by Atlantic Records on the 27th of May back in 2003 on CD. And then 5 months later on DVD audio and then Blu-ray audio in 2018.
Now, the reason why this show is very special is that one of our massive supporters, Jeff Bolett, brought a load of vinyl from the USA, where he used to live, he now lives in Portugal, and delivered it to us at a wine show Lisbon last year. And what we're doing is we're featuring the tracks or the albums that he gave us. It's probably going to take us 2 or 3 weeks to do this, but it's really cool stuff. And the only problem that we've got is that the vinyl that he gave us, there's more to Jeff than meets the eye, because he's got some connections somewhere, because all the stuff he gave us is stuff that's been signed, or it's stuff that was record only produced, like promotional stuff for record companies, radio stuff. And this track that we've just played, of course, Black Dog from the West Was Won, is not what he gave us, because what he gave us was Live in Seattle 1973, which is not available anywhere, because it's a bootleg. And it's a bootleg, and Peter Grant, of course, and Jimmy Page hate bootlegs, you know. And we can't find it. And we didn't want to actually just record the vinyl, because it required compression and all sorts of things, and it would bring up crackles and all that sort of stuff. It does sound fantastic, incidentally. So tonight, what we're doing is we're playing as close as we can get, and the closest we get tonight is Black Dog from How the West Was Won.
So we decided that we're going to call tonight's show and the next couple of shows the vinyl that Jeff gave us.
It's absolutely fantastic.
It's really exciting, you know. I mean, I don't really know many bootlegs, so it's a double album vinyl. I'm just putting my hands here. It's on a Phoenix Records label from Australia. But inside as well, there's one of those kind of nylon-y, it's still got the sticker on the back, a Backstage Access sticker pass, Led Zeppelin, 1977, North American tour.
Now, that must mean he's probably been. But you see, we need to investigate further.
We do.
And I'm sure when he listens to this show, we'll get some emails.
Very
and
excited.
We'll talk about it hopefully next week. But let's get on to Led Zeppelin and this particular album.
Yeah.
Every time that I hear this track, and certainly this album, it never ceases to amaze me the power that those three blokes actually managed to create on stage. It's energy sort of bottled and personified. The drums and the bass are like shit to a blanket. They're just totally together. You know, Jimmy Page is really on form. Because the thing about Jimmy Page, I was born on the same day as him, a few years later, like, but he can be absolute shit sometimes. And when you listen to him, you think, oh, God, that's really awful, you know? Or he's made some horrific mistakes. But here, he's really on fire. And the band are on fire. You know, Plant's on fire. John Paul Jones is remarkable as ever. What a sound, you know? It's just incredible.
Calculator. pressing down a special key, it plays a little melody.
That was Black Sabbath.
No, it was
not. Oh, no, it wasn't. No, sorry about that. It was Kraftwerk. I thought it was quite funny. Pocket Calculator from their eighth studio album, Computer World, and in German, Computerwelt. Released on 11th of May 1981 on the Kling Klang record label. I love the sound of that. And that's the studio in Dusseldorf, Kling Klang Studios. It was released as a 7-inch single in the UK in July 1981, backed with the model from the group's previous album, The Man Machine, and reached number 36 in the charts. Now, I'm looking here at a promotional Electric Yellow 7-inch single. And it's a joy. It's got the middle, the hole. If you know anything about vinyl, you can punch the middle out. So rather than a very small hole, it's like a bigger hole that you can put on. And normally you have that sort of thing in a jukebox.
Yeah,
it's like a jukebox, or the professional stations, generally speaking, have those, like the radio stations. But when you listen to this, you can hear where all those bands came from. Like all the British electronic bands, you know, Don't You Want Me Baby, you know, Human League, and all those people, you can just hear it in those sounds. And I think the sound that really got me on that is on the right hand side, where it's going over there, and it's like New Order. Now, New Order were formed in 1980. And this is 1981, so obviously they've been listening to what these dudes have been up to, you know, these crazy Germans. But absolutely fantastic. You know, what a track. And another one from Jeff's vinyl bundle. Amazing. Absolutely
amazing. Yeah. The vinyl that Jeff gave us. Now, do you know what? I've just lost the internet research function machine. did R2-D2 and C-3PO influence Kraftwerk? And it came up with Alan Perlman from ARP Synths.
Ah.
And, of course, Kraftwerk and all these amazing bands. And there was a chap called Bert at Star Wars who actually helped do the voicing for R2-D2. Because it sounds, I could almost see those two, like the comedic, robotic Laurel and Hardy at two decks messing around with this kind of, this song. Couldn't you? It's
I can't.
It's so much space in it as well.
Yeah.
It's not rushed at all, is it?
No.
They just really, it feels like they're really comfortable with this song. I'd never really heard it much before, you know.
Yeah, well, the whole Kraftwerk stuff, I mean, by this time, they'd done a lot. And it was, early on, they were making a lot of their own synthesizers and actually creating stuff from scratch. And they didn't really use drum machines. It was like more actual synths that they just got sequenced and stuff. And a lot of the hi-hats and snare drums that you think are more just white noise and stuff that are created by a normal synth rather than a drum machine. But it's absolutely fascinating when you listen to it.
Well, you know, the copy we've got, it didn't have the modeling because it's a promotional one. So the B-side is Dentaku, which is the Japanese version of the song. And they also released Pocket Calculator in German, Taschenrechner, that's right, in French, Mini Calculateur, and Italian, Mini Calculatore. What do you think?
Well,
I've never said it before in my life. I just read it now. It's
think we need our sometime keyboard player,
yeah,
Gabriel DeVecchio, to be here to say that one. Yeah. Tonight, we eat pasta.
He does. But, no, yeah, it's great when we tour with him. It's so much fun to enjoy the recording. Now, the thing is also, another thing I was looking at as well, is when this was released, so this whole sort of computer world and Pocket Calculator, it's a futuristic conceptual work which predicted the presence of computer technology in everyday life. And at the time, most people either never used a computer at all or had used no computer more advanced than a pocket calculator. And what they did as well is they actually commissioned a promotional calculator from Casio, which is the VL80 model, and they used it as a musical synthesizer. And you know, like you have sheet music with notes for instruments. Well, every number, 1, 2, 3, whatever, on a calculator had a note, and so they did sheet music, went 5, 5, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2. There's a video on YouTube about it. It's really
fantastic.
Funny. Can you imagine though, as a kid, go, oh, I can make a sound? Because I used to like try and do sounds, you know, with little keyboards and anything you can get your hands on, you were trying to make sounds. And this is like, it was released in 1981. So an incredible moment in history. You just don't realise just how much the world's changed. And funny enough, though, the whole album, right, is about computer world, but they didn't use any technology of computer technology making it. It was all analogue.
When I was a young boy, my mama said to me, there's only one girl in the world for you, and she probably lives in Tahiti. I call the whole wide world, I call the whole wide world just to find her. Or maybe she's in the Bahamas, where the Caribbean Sea is blue. We've been in a tropical moonlit night because nobody's told about you. I call the whole wide world.
Traffic,
Reckless Eric. Whole Wide World from his debut album, Reckless Eric. Released on the 1st of June in 1978 on Stiff Records. And it peaked at number 46 on the UK albums chart. And there was also a 10-inch version of the LP issued on both brown and purple vinyl in the UK.
I didn't get Reckless Eric. I never did.
I've never heard of him until we got the vinyl.
Well, he's one of those stiff artists. I don't mean stiff as in boring or whatever. He was not at all boring. But the, you know, Stiff Records actually really spearheaded that movement that was happening then, you know?
Yeah.
You know, some fantastic artists. Because Elvis Costello was on Stiff, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's true, that's actually.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, Ian Dury and all that lot. And there was a lot of them. And I think they did a tour, didn't they? I think it was called the Stiff Tour.
Yeah, they did.
If I remember correctly, my good mate, an ex-singer from the band, Tim Wright, went to see Reckless Eric at Eric's in Liverpool.
No.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I didn't go because I wasn't sort of into him. But anyway, this is a track that is not on the record that we've got off
from the
Jeff.
Vinyl that Jeff gave us.
Because the vinyl that Jeff gave us is a brown version.
We got the brown one. I mean, it's really weird as well seeing brown vinyl.
And it is almost, very, very... It's almost a bit horrible, actually.
Yeah, it is a bit horrible, actually.
Yeah, it's an horrible looking thing, but it's got a stiff logo on it. And it's a 10-inch, so it's only got, it's got two tracks missing off it. Yeah,
this one.
This one, which is his most famous.
Yeah, and another one that I can't remember now when I looked at it. But the thing is, we wanted to play this particular track. I mean, it's been covered by everyone from the Monkees to the Proclaimers. Even Green Day have covered it. It's been translated into Italiano and Finnish, and it's appeared on loads of movie soundtracks. Will Ferrell sang it in Stranger Than Fiction, and this is a great story that it recently appeared on a TV ad for a travel company starring Ewan McGregor. And this commercial debuted during the 2022 Super Bowl, which was watched, right, by 200 million people.
Holy shit.
So Whole Wide World streaming figures just went through the roof. I think we saw to over like 60 million plays, so which is great. You know, for Reckless Eric, really. So can you imagine that? 46 years and he gets over 16 million. You never know. It's a bit like the Kate Bush one, Running Up the Hill, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Really recently.
You just don't know what's going to go on or who's going to pick up your track.
And also, you know, these things like this, you know, certainly Reckless Eric, because really wasn't a big star. He didn't really do anything, you know, much after, you know, his initial thing. But, and I mean commercial success, but he's still earning a lot of money from the writing royalties, which is absolutely fantastic. And that is a great thing, you know, because he's done a good piece of work. It's a great piece of work. It's actually a great song because I listened to it when it first came out years ago, and it was only the other day that I put it on again. And I listened to it twice, the second time, and you really start to get it because it's like, it's that timing. And it comes in, you don't expect it to. And it's like, I don't know, a little quirky and it's cool. And his guitar sound, I mean, I never really thought of him as a guitar player because on the picture of the, on the front of the record, there's him with a Rickenbacker here, which is, of course, a very cool guitar, a Rickenbacker 6-string. I can't remember. I think it's a 330, actually, if I remember correctly. But basically, what he did with his guitar sound, he played it into a Fender Twin, turn right down, with all the bass turned off, so it'll sound bloody horrible. And through a Fender Champ, turned all the full way up with full treble on. So very, very odd. But, you know, it's... You know, and the other person who did that,
what?
Very, very interestingly, right, was, goodness me.
What?
The white hair. You know, Johnny Winter. Goodness me. It just escaped me. Because Johnny Winter used to do that. And funnily enough, Johnny Winter played a Firebird guitar. And two days ago, we just took delivery of my new guitar from Springer Guitars, and it's like his interpretation of a Gibson Firebird. So I've been looking at a lot of Johnny Winter and stuff, and I was reading this article about how he had all his treble on four and all the bass of his album. So there you are, yeah. That's strange but true.
So it's fascinating, though. As I progress in my sort of I don't know, the storytelling with instruments and stuff, you really get to understand the guitars, don't you, and the stories and the tones and what they can bring, and that yeah. combination with the amp. And really, there's, and also it's all in your fingers as well, and it's how you express
it's
it.
All in your fingers.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing, because when I put this, plugged this Firehawk in the other day, surprisingly enough, it's got a different pickups on, because it's not like a mini humbucker, not going to get too technical. It's a different, completely different type of pickup. But guess what? It just sounded like me playing guitar. And, you know, and that's the thing. I can play anything. It sounds the same. And Jimmy Page would be the same, or any guitar player, you know.
Yeah.
You've all got your own sound. Same with you with bass, you know.
It's funny, you know. You don't talk about the sound as well. You know, with this album, there's something really freaky happened, right? So it was recorded, I love the name of this, at Bar Snack Studios, produced by Larry Wallace. Now, the B-side of the single release, actually, featured Ian Dury, who's playing
right?
drums. Yeah, it was produced by it. And on the album as well, you've got Lick Lowe as well producing. And you've got Davey Payne, who's alto sax from the Blockheads. And what happened, right? Someone sped the album up in the cut, so it sounds like Mickey Mouse. So everything ended up being not in the key of E, it ended up being one up in the air in key of F.
Is that right?
I know. It's mad. And recently, I just read an interview in the Guardian. I said, not in the garden. in the Guardian. And he moved to Limoges, you know, in France. And we've got some really good friends there, Cass Hawkins and
yeah.
David Saunderson. And he was saying that his money was running low and people would go, you don't know what you're doing, because he was in this, he was going to the studio and he wasn't, you know, he was experimenting. And he said, if I knew what I was doing, I'd know what was going to happen. And if you know what's going to happen, there's very little point, because this is supposed to be an adventure when it comes to making new music. It could be quite wonderful or it could be quite glum. It's not like I'm disadvantaged. I'm differently advantaged.
Bebop Deluxe, Made in Heaven, from the album Live in the Air Age, released in 1977 on the Harvest record label. They just toured the US and the album was recorded on the subsequent UK tour promoting their fourth studio album, Modern Music, fantastic record. Although no songs from the studio album appeared on this live one, apart from a tantalising snippet of the audience singing along with Down on Terminal Street, and recorded with the Rolling Stones' Mobile.
I love that. It's romantic, isn't it?
Well, absolutely. And this is another track from the vinyl
that Jeff gave us.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Jeff, if you haven't didn't listen later on, he came to Lisbon to a wine show with his lovely wife Rhonda, and gave us this.
We did an exchange in public.
Yeah, a pack. He had this bag of vinyl. It was like a very odd thing to happen, and but it was fantastic.
It was great, wasn't it? Mm. It's like we'd never met before, and it was just like, okay, well, where are you? Well, we're near this sort of Alentage wine section or something, and then he came over. It was like,
we brought all this way from the US. And I remember before he was digging around his record collection, he couldn't bring it all with him because he's moved over here now to Portugal. And he asked what we liked, you know, and he sort of got it because he knows a lot about what we do.
Yeah.
But I said, you know, I said, well, we like a lot of live albums, and a lot of the stuff is given live. And this is a fantastic thing because the actual vinyl, talked about the vinyl, you got it there.
I'm holding it because it's just like, oh, I just love vinyl. It's such a romance. So it's a double album and one white vinyl and one black vinyl. And when you look at it, you've got to play side one of the white vinyl, which is the album. Then you go to side two, which is on the black EP.
Black.
And there's a song called Shine, which is 9 minutes and 18 seconds long.
Excellent.
Then you swap the black vinyl over, and it's still the EP with Sister Siegel and this song, Made in Heaven. And then you go back to the white vinyl for side four, you see? So there's something about that. It's something about the fact, you know, that tradition, that ritual. And they thought about it, and they wanted you to hold it and to have it and to have some meaning, you know. And that's kind of a lot of the time why we love the vinyl experience as well, because it's actually something that it's part of your life. It's not just something in the background or you're scrolling past something.
Absolutely, totally. And that is the reason why, you know, our new record, Start One, which is out on vinyl, has to be played in two sides. Play it all side A, turn it over, and then play side B.
In a one, yeah.
Absolutely. But back to this record.
Yes.
I always forget how much Bill Nelson had an influence on my guitar playing. Because if you listen to some of those licks on there, I've nicked them. There's wholesale theft of Bill Nelson licks. That, that I've played it for years. And I actually forgot, you know. And my good friend, Hercule, Howard Fisher, who's in England, he's an artist, a very, very talented man. I've known him for centuries, you know. And he's a huge Bebop Deluxe fan. And I remember him playing to me all these records, and we just loved them. You know, we used to sit in his kitchen, you know, drinking coffee with his mum there, and me and a guy called Craig Walton, who is another great friend of mine. And we used to listen to it. It was amazing, you know. We set the vinyl, turn it over, and we'd be talking about it. But Crying to the Sky is one of my favourite guitar solos of all time. It's just a remarkable, you know, sound. It sounds like he's tearing his neck off. It's fiendishly loud. It just sounds absolutely brilliant.
Wow. And do you know what I love about this whole... See, your stories, I just love it. I just love it. So when they hadn't actually recorded anything live before. So the band's performance, though, you'll get this right, formed part of a multimedia show.
No.
Yeah, with slides and excerpts from Fritz Lang's masterpiece, Metropolis, which played a role in creating a different experience for the run-of-the-mill gig. And that's what's really, this serendipity of this is really bizarre. Sometimes it gives me goosebumps because we've got a two-week headline UK tour at the end of September, and on Friday the 6th of October, we're going back to your hometown of Bury.
Mm-hmm.
We're playing at the Met, which is the most beautiful theatre venue. And we are doing a multimedia presentation for one night only to celebrate the release of Starlight One.
I think about winter when I was with her and the snow was falling down. Warm by the fire, I love being no one else around, and I'm falling, oh, I'm falling,
wrote my name in the sand. We walked together, hoping forever. Please don't let go of my.
LeBlanc and Carr, Falling, and that was released as a single from their album Midnight Light in October 1977 on the Big Tree record label. And it spent 28 weeks on the American charts. It reached number 11 on the Cash Box chart and Adult Contemporary chart, as well as the Canadian Pop Singles chart. And I have in my hand a different album, because this is not available commercially. So the vinyl that Jeff gave us happens to be the LeBlanc Carr Band live from the Atlantic Studios. I feel a bit goosebumply, actually, because I've got a letter here with a big A on it from Atlantic Records. It's typed, you know, like in those letters from those days gone by. June the 30th, 1978, from Bruce Tenenbaum. All music and program directors. Enclosed is a very special album. It's the third in our special series, Live from the Atlantic Studios. As you may know, these recordings are made for radio station use only and recorded before an audience at the historic Atlantic Studios in New York City. These albums are not available commercially. The first two albums in the series featured AC/DC and Detective. And he was just going on. It was just a fantastic album, which was recorded during the Intercollegiate Broadcast System, IBS, convention in New York City in March. And he was saying, the album's introduced by Lee Arnold of WAAF-FM, engineered by Jimmy Douglas. And just big cooperation and collaboration from loads of others and Big Tree Records. And it's...
Well, all I can say is thank
stunning.
You very much,
thanks, Jeff
Fuller. Amazing. 1977, when this came, of course, if you think about listening to it now, and it's soft rock, punk was happening. So it was 28 weeks in the American charts, and punk was all over the UK. You know, the Ramones were happening in the US. I've been happening for some years with Debbie Harry. All that lot, it was all happening, and this comes out and did very well. But talk about serendipity. You know, it's a very special record, this. You know, and we've played the studio version, but the studio version was recorded at Wishbone Studios. And when we went over to Muscle Shoals last year, we met Billy Lawson, who now owns it. We went in, so we stood in the same studio that this was recorded in.
Yeah.
Dylan LeBlanc, who we know from a friend of ours, Monty Hitchcock, who used to be his manager and the manager of Emmylou Harris, right, is the son of
Lenny LeBlanc.
Yeah. So, and we've met Dylan a couple of times. We've seen him live.
Lovely, great artist.
In fact, if you check him out, he's really, really cool. And it's just such a serendipitous thing.
Music family.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre, isn't it? So you've got, like, so down the road you've got, like, Recall from Fame Studios, and then the Swampers, and you've got them at the Muscle Shoals Sound Studio at 3614 Jackson Highway. And then we've, and of course, we've got to mention Johnny Blue, Rhythm
Indeed.
And Blues Tours, of the guy to get in contact with when you're down in Muscle Shoals, because he's a fixer. He's a big love machine. The circle gets bigger. He'll connect you up. He'll take you around. And of course, you have to make a stop and go see James at Counts Brothers Music. Brilliant music store and really, really fantastic people. It just made us feel so welcome, and it's
we had a whale of time. And I think that the whole thing is that whole place is steeped in music. And when you look at the records that we've done there, because we went over to Memphis first, and then later on Nashville, and that whole area, it's within a few hours of each other. You know, it is the hotbed of music. It's incredible the stuff that's come out of there.
And just what I didn't realise that too much about Dylan's history as well. And it's funny to find out about his dad, because he started playing bass as well as singing background vocals. And so he's like recorded with Hank Williams Jr., Etta James, Joan Baez, Amy Grant, Roy Orbison. And it was when they recorded a demo, and his mate Carr, who'd actually become quite a successful studio guitarist at Muscle Shoals, he sent it off to Jerry Wexler at Atlantic Records, and Wexler really liked them, and that's how they got started. So I think, doesn't it make you just grin with joy?
Joy.
I just like to say before I start that it's one of the pleasures of my life to be able to be on this stage with these people tonight. They got it now, Robbie.
Thank you.
The Band, featuring Neil Young, Helpless, from that fantastic film The Last Waltz, deluxe version, their second live album released on Warner Brothers Records in 1978. It's the soundtrack to the 1978 film of the same name, and the final album by the original configuration of the band, peaking at number 16, the Billboard 200. Now, we talked about Robbie Robertson last week, who sadly passed away very recently. So we're not going to talk about an awful lot about Robbie this week, because you can go back to last week's show if you want to. However, we are going to talk about this track. We've got to remember here that this is live.
Mm-hmm.
This is Americana at its finest. It's Neil Young singing his heart out with amazing backing vocals and a wonderful, wonderful band, The Band.
Wow. And you know what? It was produced by Jonathan Taplin, and he had actually produced Martin Scorsese's film Mean Streets, so he got Scorsese on board to film the actual concert. And this concert, The Last Waltz, is legendary. It's a landmark motion picture. It's the first 35mm rock film ever made and the first to use a 24-track recording system which produced the 4-track Dolby stereo print. And Scorsese wrote a detailed 300-page shooting script which was choreographed for every band lyric and chord change with a camera movement. There were 8 cameras, 6 sound men. They rented the set from La Traviata from the San Francisco Opera Company for $8,000, and they used chandeliers that came from the props department at 20th Century Fox.
Low budget production then.
I know. So you've got to check it out. It's fantastic. So the vinyl that Jeff gave us, we have a promotional copy.
We do.
Not for sale. And it's got this amazing booklet with all the lyrics and everything and all the people that played.
Some great black and white photographs
on
as well,
the concert.
Promotional black and white.
Oh,
it's amazing.
Oh, we're going to frame them, actually. Jeff, thank you so much. We've got a gold, The Band, The Last Waltz. And I just thought I'd summarise up in reading you the first page of the text of the letter they wanted to write to us who bought the album,
okay,
or were given the album. This is from The Band. The road was our school. It gave us a sense of survival. It taught us everything we know, and out of respect, we don't want to drive it into the ground. Or maybe it's just superstition, but the road has taken a lot of the great ones. It's a goddamn impossible way of life. The band has been together 16 years together on the road. 8 years in dance halls, in dives and bars. 8 years of concerts, arenas and stadiums. Our first concert as The Band had been at Winterland, so we wrapped it up there on Thanksgiving Day. There was a dinner for 5,000, a waltz orchestra, a hell of a party, and some friends showed up to help us take it home. But they are much more than friends. They are some of the greatest influences on music and on a whole generation. We wanted it to be more than a final concert. We wanted it to be a celebration. The Last Waltz.
Go, go.
the Rolling Stones, Brown Sugar, the opening track and lead single from their 9th British but 11th American studio album, Sticky Fingers, released on the 16th of April 1971 on the Rolling Stones label. And it became a number one hit in both the USA and Canada. And in the UK and Ireland, it charted at number 2.
Amazing. Amazing.
Classic.
Muscle Shoals sound. It was recorded out. And we're talking about, because of course, Muscle Shoals were in, and all that stuff you talked about. Anyway, Keith finished it, and he went, at the end, you can always do it. But there's two things about that record. The first thing is that it's not very powerful. You expect it to come in with great gusto. It doesn't, you know, the drums are mixed right back. That guitar line is tremendous, you know. And on the cover of the record, of course, Mick Taylor's there, and he looks so out of place. He doesn't look like a Rolling Stone at all. He's sort of just looking there, a bit geeky. Because, of course, you know, great guitar player. And, of course, the iconic cover and everything else. And this is we've got the vinyl from Jeff, the vinyl that Jeff gave us. And this is a special half-speed pressing that we've got. It's amazing what he's done. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Do you know what's really funny as well? The actual album cover, it's got like an embossed gold zip on
the
trousers. I'd never seen that before.
I think the original had a proper zip on it.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Andy Warhol, I believe.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Andy Warhol.
So it's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah, you're right though. There's like an inset, a paper thing, and the guys just look like you just can't quite believe that they were that young, can you?
No. And of course, they've been at it 10 years then, and after all the stuff that had been taken. Anyway.
So this was produced by Jimmy Miller.
Indeed. We did a show on him, right? One of the very first shows we did, about number 6 or something. We're on 136 now.
We did loads of producers, you know, the really influential people of that time, really, for this sort of era of blues and rock and stuff. And they didn't release a song, you know, for about over a year because they had some legal wranglings. Isn't it funny? Always something to do with that. And at the request of guitarist Mick Taylor, who joined the band as Brian Jones' replacement in July 69, the Stones debuted the number live during their infamous concert at the Altamount Speedway.
Yeah,
on the 6th of December. And they were talking about the lyrics, you know. And Mick Jagger was saying, you know, he probably wouldn't write the same way as he did then, because I think that he's changed the lyrics now, actually. So I think I hear him whip the women just around midnight. It's been replaced with the more simple, you should have heard him just around midnight.
Mm.
So song of the times,
well,
really.
Well, that's it, yeah. And, you know, but people actually change things now. Anyway, if you want to listen to that Jimmy Miller podcast, they're all here on vibes.starlight-campbell.com.
This week is a really special week for us because we finally get to release Starlight One. And it's available on 180 gram milky clear vinyl and CD. We're very, very excited. And join us next week for part 2 of the vinyl that Jeff gave us on the Supertone Show.